Welcome to the Muscle Expert Podcast with Ben Pakulski, one of the world's top professional bodybuilders, an expert on human performance and mindset mastery. Ben dives deep to deliver the strategies of the top experts to upgrade your body, mind, muscle, strength, performance, biochemistry, and how to become the upgraded modern man. Join us on BenPakulski.com to learn the cutting-edge techniques to take control of your body, your brain, and create your greatest life.
And just before we get to the episode today, I just want to say a quick thank you to Gasp Clothing for their support of the podcast. I've been a longtime friend of the brand. I've been using and wearing Gasp for well over 10 years. And as you guys all know, the quality is second to none. And I personally really enjoy the clothing, as well as the awesome lifting accessories they have. They've sent me some belts and some straps and some wrist guards and things like that, knee sleeves that I literally use every time that heavy lifting is the goal. Now, for our U.S. listeners, Gasp has been generous enough to offer a 10% discount. And if you guys know Gasp, they don't offer discounts a lot. So for the listeners of the Muscle Expert Podcast, we have a discount code. Use code BEN10, capital B-E-N, number 10. You can check it out at GaspBB.com. That's GaspBB.com. And as I said, they really offer discounts, which is pretty awesome. I actually love a lot of their clothing. You know, it's actually what I wear to train pretty much all the time. If you're not familiar with their stuff, check out the World Off hoodie. It's pretty sweet. They just brought back a throwback hoodie, which is like a three-quarter length or a quarter length hoodie. Pretty awesome. I always love wearing their long sleeves. Really, really thin and perfect for training. So check out GaspBB.com. Use code BEN10. And now back to the episode.
Hey guys, Ben Pakulski. I've been sent this product recently. I've been using it for about 3 months and I'm absolutely loving it. It's a digestive enzyme specifically formulated to increase proteolytic breakdown. So they have an awesome video demonstration on how it breaks down protein on the next page. If you want to check it out, I highly suggest you do that. It's called Masszymes by Optimizers. Actually, a great friend of mine owns the company. They're based out of Canada. They did a ton of research into optimizing protein digestion. So guys like me and you are eating tons of protein in our diet, but really how much are you actually digesting and absorbing? It's never about what you eat, it's what you absorb. So I've been taking these for, like I said, about 3 months now. I notice I have much less bloating. I'm still eating like a good 12 ounces of meat every meal. Which is a lot, but I don't eat a lot of meals anymore. I eat like 3 to 4 meals a day, so my amounts have gone up, and I find I get no bloating, no indigestion, no gas, and I really feel awesome. It's a really, really great product, a really wide spectrum of digestive enzymes. Another thing I've been doing lately on his recommendation is actually taking it between meals to decrease inflammation. So excess protein can sometimes leak into the bloodstream and attach onto joints and cause kind of inflammatory joints and joint pain. So by taking 2 or 3 of them between meals, I'm actually noticing a pretty big difference in the amount, the way my joints feel. So you guys can check them out. They've also offered us a 10% discount, which is pretty sweet. So check it out.
What's up? Welcome back. Muscle Expert Podcast. I'm your host, Ben Pakulski, and today another fascinating, brilliant guest. Mr. Brett Contreras. He's got a PhD in sports science with an emphasis in biomechanics. You can find him at brettcontreras.com. And before we get started, I want to remind you guys to head over to iTunes, subscribe, leave us a review, because I have more amazing guests coming at you. But right now, we're going to dive deep on Brett Contreras, the research he's doing. So this guy's on the cutting edge. He's doing some really, really fascinating stuff, digging deep and expanding his knowledge base. And the favorite thing that I've known about Brett, I've known him for about 5 minutes, and he said to me that he doesn't know everything and he wants to keep learning. And that says to me that he's an awesome, brilliant guy, and we're going to get along really well. How are you, man?
Doing great, Ben. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, man. I'm excited. You're one of the guys.
And Brad Schoenfeld yesterday, I talked to him several times a week, but yeah. He was saying good things about you, and he just did your podcast, said it was great.
He did, man. I try to be open-minded, and I want everybody to collaborate. And I love the fact that you're open-minded, because a lot of guys who, you know, term themselves or coin themselves as professionals tend to think they know everything and don't want to hear, you know, the other side of the coin. So I love the fact that we can have an open-minded discussion about what's working and what's not. And that's ultimately all that matters, right, is results. So very, very appreciative to have you on, man. And so I know you've been in the trenches doing a lot of research. Can you talk a little bit about your background and, you know, athletics? So before we get into, you know, what you're doing currently, giving people a bit of a history about who you are, where you came from.
So this journey started at 15 when I was just so tired of being skinny. Me and my twin brother were made fun of so bad. We looked back then, the Ethiopians were so skinny. People would say we were Ethiopian, but I was tall and so skinny. All the girls weighed more than me, and I got made fun of. My grandma would put her hand around my arm. Her fingers could touch, and she'd shake her head. And so I was just tired of getting picked on, tired of being so skinny. So I wanted to do something about it. It was funny. I was talking to my twin brother last night. I said, "Do you remember when I first started working out? I weighed 15 pounds more than you, and we were looking in the mirror, like we had just shorts on. And I'm like, where is this 15 pounds? And he's like, how do you weigh? Where is it? I'm like, and I went up the chain. I was like, my calves are the same as yours. My thighs, there's no, like, it was so weird. I guess at first you just maybe increase your density and don't, but
sure.
It took me like 5 years to get him to lift with me. But, I'd go to the stores and read all the muscle magazines, and I wouldn't buy them all. I would just sit there and read them and go to the bookstores, and I read all the muscle magazines, and then the internet came out, but what's funny is when I started training, we didn't have the resources we have now. So now I was trying all the exercise. I remember trying squats and going, this does not feel right. I don't think I'm doing this right. I mean, I was so lanky. I didn't even now squats are tough for me. Like not front squats are fine, but I want to lean over and shoot my hips up. So I just didn't do them. And I remember trying deadlifts, and I'm like, clearly I just rounded over completely, and I'm like, I don't think I'm doing these right. So I just wouldn't do them, and I couldn't do dips. I couldn't do chin-ups. In fact, when we all started lifting back for for sports, I couldn't bench the bar. My friends could do it for like 10 reps, and they'd be like, what's wrong with you? And I'm like, I don't know. I guess I'm just so weak. But I stuck with it. And then, I remember, so this is what got me into glutes. First I heard these girls at high school that I had a crush on talking about, let's go watch football. You've seen Todd and Clay's butt in their football pants. It's so nice. And God, and then talking about whose butt looks best in jeans. And I'm like, God, I'm going to be a virgin for life if that's what they care about. So, and then I was playing golf, and my sister's boyfriend was like, I was bending over to swing the club, and he's like, Brett, it's crazy. You have no butt. It's almost like you're missing those muscles. Like your legs go right into your back. So I was like, I'm not okay with this. I have to do something about this. I have to, I was like, I have pecs now because I do push-ups and bench, and I'm getting some arm muscles. I need to learn about glute muscles and how to build them. And so by the age of 19, I was training all my friends and my family members, and my cousin actually bought me this book, The Complete Guide to Butt and Leg Development. I still have it. And now I'm 40 years old, and my enthusiasm for glutes has never waned. And now I wrote my own book on glute development. So
for you, man. Give me some measurements. How tall are you, and what did you weigh at that age?
Oh, so back, yeah. So I'm 6'4", 245 right now. And I just got a DEXA scan. I was 17% body fat. I've never gotten down to single digits. I don't know what I'd have to get down to in body weight to get down to, like, I'd probably have to, the reason why I don't is because I would have to get down to like, probably 200 pounds, and then I'd have no legs. In clothes, I'd look like I don't even lift. So there's like a sweet spot. But back then, well, I remember like my sophomore year of high school, weighing 130, and the girls weighed like 130. A couple girls weighed 135, and they were joking around how they're bigger than me.
Were you 6'4"?
I think I was like, I wasn't 6'4", but I had a growth spurt, like from sophomore to senior year. I shot up like 8 inches taller or something. Wow. Crazy. But I also put on 80 pounds because I just started eating everything. And at first it was just, I don't care what kind of weight I gain. And then I realized, like, I had a little belly for a few months of my life, and I was like, this is worse than being skinny. Like, I look terrible. I need to, you know, I need to be muscular. So yeah, it's been this constant process of trying to learn more. And then, you know, my first 8 years of lifting, I just did body part split training. Then I remember stumbling upon this website, like Hard Gainer and Cyber Pump, and I tried the one set to failure protocols. And then when Teen Nation came out, started reading them, and you know, learning about powerlifting routines and trying lower upper and more like more of those routines, and then trying total body training, and now I do total body training, but that fascinates me, the different types of splits and programs along with exercise. I love geeking out on exercise biomechanics and speculating about what would be best for what purpose. And that's why Brad Schoenfeld and I get along so well. His whole, you know, three primary mechanisms of muscle hypertrophy, there's mechanical tension, metabolic stress, and muscle damage.
Yep.
Well, there's exercises, not only exercise, but also methods that would bring about more tension, more metabolic stress, more muscle damage. And that's when I'm more into the biomechanics and he's more into the physiology. So we've always gotten along really well.
Cool, man. That's awesome. You know, I have my own scrawny to Jack story too, man. I remember vividly curling the 12-pound dumbbells and struggling when I started. I was 150 pounds, 5'10", but I got a big bone structure. And I remember watching guys curl the 17-pound dumbbells and I just couldn't physically do it. And it just broke me. It just absolutely broke me. Like now looking at it, it's comical, but same with the, you know, benching the bar, same idea, man. We all start somewhere, right?
I think it's hard for people to realize that we were once skinny and weak, just like they might be, you know?
Yeah, yeah. And that's why it's important that they know that, man. You know, we were there too. I was a vegetarian, 150 pounds, long distance runner. Didn't even know what weight room was, man, until I started playing baseball and football. And you see all your buddies going, and you're like, okay, I want to do this. And then I really liked it. And then I stopped playing sports and just pursued weightlifting at the time.
Yep.
Yeah, it's funny how that goes. So how did it come full circle to where you obviously went through and did your education and just recently got your PhD, right?
Yeah, I think it was a couple years back. I finally got awarded. But I was a high school math teacher for my first 6 years. I was personal training on the side, and I remember thinking, man, I can't make money as a personal trainer. There's, you know, I need a career. And so it was either firefighting or teaching. And I liked the idea of having summers off for teaching. So I went with teaching. Sure. The Arizona's really, back then we were like 50th out of all 50 states for state funding for education. I don't know how it is now, but my salary was just so, I taught for Scottsdale School District and I started out at like 29,000 and I ended, and this was a master's degree plus 24 extra credit hours. I was making 38,000.
Wow.
And you top out, if you get 30 years of teaching with a PhD, you top out at 59,000. So
jeez.
That's two funny stories about why I left education. I had for my master's degree, I had a professor that she said, you know, you can do your thematic unit. This was for grad school. You can do your thematic unit on any topic you want. And I'm like, I don't have to do one on math. I can do it on exercise science. She's like, yeah, you could do it on ice cream if you want. So I did mine on exercise science, and she called me up and she said, Brett, in 13 years of being a professor, this is the best project I've ever received. Life's too short. You need to pursue your passion. I have no doubt you're a good math teacher, but you gotta pursue exercise science in some capacity. And that got the wheels turning, and I was personal training on the side. And then a female teacher I was really good friends with came in after school, and she's like, we were talking, she goes, you know, you're almost perfect on paper. It's like, you're tall, you're handsome, you're funny, you're charming, you're intelligent, you're athletic. I guess your only flaw is you don't make any money, but that's not that big of a deal. And she walked out, and I was doing over that one, you know, that we focus on the one thing. And I'm like, I'm not okay with this. So what's funny is I remember I joined Amazon that day and I bought two books. One was by Robert Kiyosaki.
Yep, Rich Dad Poor Dad.
It was Cash Flow Quadrant. And the other was some book by Robert Kiyosaki and Donald Trump, which is kind of funny.
Yep.
It was on making money. But to this day, I've never read any books on marketing or anything. The only business book I ever read was E-Myth. This, you know, and then I took, and then I made the leap. I quit teaching. That was scary. I quit teaching. I opened up a personal training studio and had that for 2 years, but that's right when the economy collapsed and my plaza went under. So I'm like, well, what can I do now? And I started blogging and doing social media. And it's funny because back then my friends were all making fun of me, like, oh my God, you're a blogger. And I'm like, I just thought blogging was so nerdy back then. But yeah, I became an active. I blogged 4 times a week for like 7 years or something, 6 years. And then funny how the industry changes, because now I'm not blogging much because it's, you don't get much. I mean, I blog on Facebook and it gets like 7 likes, one from my mom or something. It's like not the same anymore.
It's all video, right? Everyone.
Yeah, and infographics and things like that. So you got to flow with the times without kind of selling out and compromising who you are. So now I do more stuff on Instagram. But yeah, it's you got to stay on top of the technology and you know, I think Facebook just wants people to buy things. So I don't sponsor my ads. I need to learn that. But I quit blogging so much, and now I just focus more on Instagram. But I've worked my ass off for the last decade to get a name in this industry, and so now it's so rewarding, because I think if I won the lottery or something, I'd be doing the same thing. I'd just have a nicer house and maybe have assistants and a better lab or something to work in.
Now, so I want to kind of start going down that route, man. Looking at what you're diving into now, because I know you want to pride yourself on being the cutting edge of, you know, glute development, obviously, but all biomechanics. And so the couple of things I want to ask you is, you know, who have been your biggest influencers over the last 5 and 10 years? And, you know, where's your mindset right now?
Okay, so to answer what you asked previously, my lab is my garage gym. I have a 4-car garage gym. And I've loved it for the last few years, but then you grow and you want to expand, and now I'm sick of it. Well, it's so hot here in Phoenix, I can't train here right now. Even though I have air conditioning, it's still too hot to train in the evenings, and I don't want to wake up at like 6 a.m. and train. So, that's my lab. I have an EMG unit, I have a force plate, I have an ultrasound unit, and I spent like $30,000 on those three things.
Yep.
Just to be able to publish research, and I didn't get my PhD to become a research professor. I knew I'd never do that, but I'm a first author or co-author on like 44 published papers now, a lot of them with Brad, but I have like what's cool is I'm not that good at stats. I'm not that good at writing. I'm good at, you know, I like carrying out the research. I like coming up with the methodology and stuff. But when you publish a paper, it's a team. So I can find people that make up for my shortcomings, and then we put forth good research. But actually, later on, I want to tell you how I was wrong in some areas. And Brad and I always joke, we're like 50, we bat around 50% with our hypotheses. We're dead sure it's going to come out one way, and it doesn't. But you learn. That's how you learn. But I just did a bunch of stuff with ASU in collaboration with a professor there, but I'd like to have a more, you know, I'd like to have one day I want to have, you know, like a couple research assistants working for me, and because I have so many things I wonder about. For example, the whole industry thinks that I still know your next questions. I won't forget about those. But the things I want to research are. Like three things I'd love to research right now. The whole industry thinks that like barbells are so superior and machines are so inferior for like athletic performance and for hypertrophy and everything. And I think we're so off the mark with that. And people will lump all machines together. So they'll think like that a lever machine squat is akin to like a leg extension. And that's just not the case. I bet you anything we could have one group doing barbell lifts and then another group doing like plate loaded counterparts, like plate loaded squats, deadlifts, bench press, whatever. and then look at the transfer to performance, and you'd see no differences whatsoever. So then the conclusion could be, if you're a strength coach that likes barbells, use barbells. If you're a machine guy, use the plate loaded, because either one of them is fine, leads to the same performance adaptations, but also you can determine which one you think is safer for the athletes. Because if I was training a multi-million dollar, like a pro team with multi-million dollar athletes, I don't know if I'd want them deadlifting or squatting.
Sure. It depends. Like you say, safety is number one. And how much have you dived into like muscle architecture? So this is something we teach here at the gym, right? Is looking at muscle architecture and how that influences strength profiles, and how you should be perhaps appropriately matching logically your strength profile to a resistance profile to get the maximum efficiency of exercise, right? Have you dug into muscle architecture?
I'm muscle architecture. Actually, in biomechanics, the definition of muscle architecture is like there's three things. I think that there's normalized fascicle length, pronation angle, and physiological cross section. But the thing that I think is most exciting is the research coming out now, and I'm good friends with these guys, with JB Morin and his colleagues. They look at your force velocity profile, and then they publish research now showing that when they, because kind of most of us strength coaches just do we throw everything at them. We need to get you strong and powerful. So you're going to do squats, you're going to do vertical jumps, you're going to do jump squats, you're going to do Olympic lifts. Well, they've shown that when you individualize the routine to the person's weaknesses, then you see the better results to power production compared to when you give them the shotgun approach with everything. So if you're like you and I, Ben, would be very force dominant because we do heavy lifting and not a lot of plyos and things like that. So you and I, if we wanted to get really good at sports real quick, we have all the strength we need. We would have to just do, but what they found was not even jumps. They'll do like band assisted jumps, and like where you lay on a skateboard and push off the wall.
Right.
Because the contraction velocities are even faster, and that brings about even quicker results that way. So kind of that stuff fascinates me. But anyway, that's one question. There's a squat study that this guy Matt Ray just published last year, and it was showed that quarter squats transferred better to jumps and sprinting than half and full squats, and it needs to be duplicated because
At it, man, it's because it's so specific, right? You know, if you're going to train someone in an 8-inch range of motion at the top of the range and then have them do an 8-inch range of motion into a jump, there's going to be a lot of transfer there. But when you start getting into the depth of a squat where it's going to be harder, the speed is going to be decreased, right? So it's almost like I don't think there's a correlation, because it would make sense to me logically that, yes, a squat in the top 8 inches of the range would correlate most to a jump, but that doesn't mean I need to neglect the other aspects of the range, because it will still have benefits. It just may be a different application.
I agree. There's reasons to be suspicious about this study, because none have looked at squat depth and sprinting. That's the first of its kind to look at that. But there are a couple, 2 to 3 other studies that show that deeper squats transferred better to vertical jumps. So when you get a paper that shows different results, you need more research to kind of shed some light on that. But if that's true, then it means that we were too hard on quarter squats in the past, and they should be included in athletic programs. Not that you need to avoid deeper squats. It's just that you can also do, which a lot of Olympic coaches have done, quarter squats and things like that. It just means that they're not useless like people tend to assume.
Sure, but then you bring in the conversations, adding in something like accommodating resistance on a squat, where if you actually make the top of the range the most difficult or at least the most resisted, maybe that has the greatest transfer, right? So what if I don't have a tremendous amount of force at the bottom, and I can still generate some acceleration from the bottom, and then having to push through that part at the top because it's resisted by the band? Then that to me,
there's so much research on that, the accommodating resistance research with bands and chains, that we should all athletes should be doing that, but it's not as popular as it should be. But there's so much research on that now showing that even with strength transfer, which always surprises me, because I love chain squats and chain front squats, but I think specificity is always king. Like you always get the best results training the most specific way possible. A lot of them show better strength transfer, like better transfer to squats when you do chains Well, I would think it would be the opposite. So it might be novelty. I mean, we don't have enough.
I mean, logically, if he's saying so, transfer as far as if I want to improve my squat, I need to squat versus I need to improve or I need to do a chain squat.
Right.
So logically, man, if you're looking at a squat and you look at the resistance or the strength profile of the exercise, it's going to be most difficult at the bottom and have the least amount of challenge at the top as you kind of appropriate the limbs, right? You come to a position where they're stacked. So that there's that 50% of the range that isn't being challenged. So as soon as you add the chains and it starts adding more challenge the higher you go up, that's just going to logically challenge the musculature to a greater degree as you come up. So, you know, that would be my argument, is that then you're actually increasing the overall stimulus and tension, right?
Yeah. So you have the highest torques at the knee and hip, but right at 90 degrees, like right at, well, not 90, but right at parallel, because the knees and hips are the furthest out from the force vector. But so that's theoretically where the hardest point are in terms of joint torques, but the sticking region is a little bit above that. So, but you know, but then sometimes you'll see like some of these, Ray, God, what's his name? Ray, is it Williams? The like dude who's that big giant black dude who squats like 1,000 pounds raw. He'll fail at the top due to fatigue. So there's a lot of ways to look at it. Look at how popular Westside has been, but that's for geared powerlifting. But they say that they would do the same way when training raw for raw powerlifting. And you can't argue about their success, but then you look at all the best raw squatters and they're doing mostly specificity. So I always, when I try to form my opinion, I look at the biomechanics and logical rationale. I look at that. Then I look at if there are training studies on it.
Right.
And then you look at how the best of the best are training. And,
sure.
You know, because they tend to figure stuff out along the way. That's not to say but at the very least, there's a time and a place for it. You know, maybe you should do a lot of that. Like, I remember Ed Cohn back in the day. He'd have an off season where he did high bar full squats and then he'd switch to more specificity. But that's why this field is so fascinating. There's so many ways to design good programs and that make a lot of sense. But sure. I agree with you. When you do chain squats, you do load it up. It's kind of like you shift, you take away the mechanical advantage and flatten out the strength curve.
Exactly. So, Man, so looking at squat from my perspective, a squat is massively skill oriented, right? Like, average person can't get under a squat and just squat. They have to learn. There's a huge learning curve. So learning that with perfection, I think, is a massive asset for people looking to get strong. So as soon as you start loading it too much, and there's any degree of breakdown in the range, you're gonna compromise, or there's any breakdown in the form, you're gonna compromise the skill, and you're gonna compromise your ability to perform the skill. So we like to break it down. So we challenge the squat, but we never challenge the squat to the point that it breaks, or we try to toe the line, but then we realize that this is just a culmination of muscles contracting simultaneously to move load. And so training individual joints or individual muscles through patterns that are similar to a squat seems to have a lot of sense too. And that's one thing I don't see a lot of coaches doing. Some of them, the better ones, do, but just like looking at an exercise and analyzing, well, where is it breaking and what muscle is the weakest link, and then how can we isolate that muscle? And that's one thing that Louis talks a lot about at Westside, is like, if you break somewhere, I'm going to find what breaks. I'm going to train it and train it and train it and train it and train it. And then I'm going to beat it. And then you're going to go, squat is never going to break again. So we're going to make it a strength. And that's one thing he talks about a lot. And that's, you know, the most simple and logical approach, I think, is if you have the analytical mind like you do, you look at an exercise and you can see, hey, that joint is failing, or the muscles that move that joint are failing. Let's go train that in isolation and do some hypertrophy work or some strength work or even some metabolic work if that's what's necessary. And make that not be a weak link.
So in the literature right now, there's been a pendulum swing, largely due to this researcher named Jeremy Lenicky, but I think it's gone too far. He's rightfully shown that the link between hypertrophy and strength gains, the change in hypertrophy and change in strength aren't highly correlated, as we once thought. But he's kind of caused in the literature, it's kind of gone this whole pendulum swing towards specificity, and if you want to get good at this, just do that lift if you want to get good at powerlifting, just do a ton of heavy singles and not much else. I'm a variety guy, and I'm a.
It doesn't make any sense, like because you're gonna what's gonna happen? You get wear patterns, you're getting injuries, right? Like if you want to become good at squatting, sure you need to squat, but if you're doing heavy singles, what's gonna happen? Get a break. You got to rotate your tires, right?
And you burn out, and it's hard to just like Westside does tons of heavy singles, but they're always rotating the lifts and everything. If you just do, and that's something I'd like to see more research on, transfer of one exercise to another, because there is some research, but it tends to get ignored. But we see it in the field, like especially when you stumble on that. We've all had that certain exercise where you start doing it, and then all of a sudden your deadlift shot up, and you're like, I know it was because of that lift I started doing. It doesn't happen forever. It's like if you can't do a glute ham raise, or if you can squat a ton, but then you go to do Bulgarian split squats and you get like 6 body weight, you bring that up to where you can get 20, you're going to be stronger. It's going to transfer more when you really can find your weak links.
Right. And we're just looking at joint angles, right? And that's the thing that seems to transfer into sports specificity the most is, you know, analyzing specific joint angles and where you break, and then let's train that specific part of the joint angle. You can't really argue that if it's going to have transfer. Like if I get stronger in this part of the range, it's going to have transfer everywhere, right? And that's always looking at is like if there's a particular part of this joint angle that breaks, go and beat it and learn to use the musculature around there more effectively, more efficiently, create a greater neurological patterning, motor patterning, and then hopefully we assume that we're going to have a move the needle.
You'd be preaching to the choir if it worked for last month. My barbell hip thrust, this is an interesting story. So, and it's a good case for science. I'm intending on writing a blog post about this. My hip thrust, I formed this force vector theory. So I started training people, you know, athletes like 10 years ago, and they do the hip thrust and they say, God, I'm getting faster. I'm getting faster, Brett. And I'd say, what? Okay, you're getting faster because we're strengthening your legs. We're doing. They go, no, it's the hip thrust. I go, well, why do you think it's the hip thrust? Just out of curiosity. Well, I feel my glutes working more on the ground. So that actually led to this whole like force vector hypothesis. Squats, you're moving the load upwards. Hip thrust, you're moving it forwards. Hip thrusts are they're hardest at end range where your foot is on the ground. Like that's more associated with when your foot is on the ground. And these are going to be better at transferring for sprinting, where squatting would be, you know, hip thrust better for sprinting, squatting for jumping. So that was one of my things I wanted to look at for my PhD thesis. And then we did a training study. So the theory makes good sense. It's a good logical rationale. And then even like you look at EMG, you get a little bit higher EMG output in the glutes and the hamstrings compared to squats. So it all made sense. And then we did our training study. It was on adolescent males, and they showed better acceleration in the in sprinting with the hip thrust compared to the front squat, and the front squat transferred better to jumping. And so that's what's hard as a – I have my scientist hat, and then I have my educator hat. Like, and when you're an educator, especially when you're an entrepreneur, when you're a businessman, you get rewarded – on social media when you come out with a big claim, when you
attach yourself to something.
Yeah, and it's kind of a conflict of interest with being a good scientist. So I knew, you know, on the paper with the write-up, we said limitations. Well, this was just on adolescent males. This needs to be duplicated with – we were very cautious with the conclusions. But then online, any person who talked about my study, I retweeted and I reposted and I made it – you know, I made infographics and – you know, talking about the force vector hypothesis. And then just recently, 2 studies have emerged showing, one I was a peer reviewer for and I accepted it. They showed they had subjects doing hip thrust for like one of them was 6 weeks, one of them 8 weeks. They got way stronger at hip thrust and it had no effect on sprinting speed. So that's where you're like, God, I thought I had it figured out. What the hell? So now I'm going, okay, they did heavy, heavy hip thrust where the contraction speed is slow. And the way I used to do them, actually, you know, it's funny. I think in your gym, you have a hip thruster the way I made a scorcher back then, but you have one that's like that, where it's the rounded pad and then the foot plate. But you can do those where you sink real deep.
Yep.
You can do them if you sink deep and you get a stretch in the hamstrings. That's how I was doing hip thrust back in the day when I was training athletes. When I came out with my glute book, I'm like, God, if I try and teach this exercise where everyone's doing them, off a machine. It'll just look like I'm trying to sell a machine. So I taught people how to do them off the with a barbell, without you know, just a barbell off the ground. Well, you don't get a stretch in the hamstrings that way. So I think so. Now my scientific mindset knows is now I want to look at that type of the type of hip thrust where you stretch the hamstring and a little bit faster contraction speeds, and then I bet you you'll see transfer to sprinting. But it's a constant process of relearning and refining your theories, because I was dead set that hip thrust would transfer so well to speed.
My critical mind is going, and to me it probably has to do with the population you're testing. So if you look at a population who their ability to get so you have understanding of my paradigm, where I'm looking at, like, I look at everything from a joint angle mechanics, like muscle architecture perspective. So someone who has a limitation in their ability to extend their hips, if that happens to be their limitation in their range or their limitation in their ability to get faster, and you address that, they'll get stronger or they'll get faster. Whereas if it's a different population who that wasn't their limitation, maybe they won't see a difference, right? So it may have application in certain populations and absolutely none in others.
And it's funny you mention that, because I'd like to see research go in the direction of reporting individual differences, reporting the individual data set, because what we do in research typically is we average everything together and then report it, show the statistical analysis. Sure. What would have been nice is if they had the whole data set, you could show, well, look at, there were 20 subjects. Look at this, these six guys got way faster.
Right.
And look at how weak they were in the beginning. And then you could run your own data. We don't do that. And the reason why it's like that is because back when publishing started, we didn't have online, and they were limited by pages. So they were all printed journals, but now they're all online, and there's no reason why we shouldn't switch to that. But yes, I agree. You know, if you like the weak link theory we talked about, the individualization theme keeps coming up. Because if you get someone who – I've actually trained people. This is so crazy to me. I've trained people throughout my – well, actually, this is funny because you might know this person. Troy – remember Troy Alves?
Yeah.
He was working out at a gym with my co-author, Kelly Davis, who I wrote a book with, Strong Curves, and she was doing barbell glute bridges off the ground. And I think she had, like, you know, like 225 pounds on there or something like that. And anyway, him and his buddies, he's like, what is that? What's that work? She's like, it works your glutes. And he's like, let me try it. And he could not budge the weight off the ground. So he kept coming back throughout the workout going, okay, I think I figured out your trick. And she's like, finally, she goes, there's no trick. It's just my glutes are strong. And then I guess he was with his buddies. They were laughing so hard. But Troy Alves could be doing 600 pounds within like 3 months if he started doing them. He's just weak at that range.
Right.
When you first learn an exercise, you can be really strong in deep hip flexion and then not strong at end range. But I've trained people like that who, you know, these guys are squatting 500 pounds and then I'll give them 135 pound barbell glute bridge or hip thrust and they can't budge it.
Nobody ever trains that part of the range, right? Like, when do you ever go there unless you're sprinting?
Yeah. So, but they get fat, they get way better very quickly. It's just that it's a weakness. But anyway, but then there's also people who've never even done them and can just do 600 pounds right away. And it just, so I think that has to do with our anatomy. And because I remember reading this study where they looked at hip joint center and they moved it 2 centimeters in like all 8 directions, like up, down, left, right, and then diagonally. And if you moved it like the hip joint center down into the left, you became freakishly strong at hip flexion, but weak at hip extension, and then vice versa.
Right.
So I think a lot of that, I mean, we can look at like bicycles and cars and be like, this would be better suited for this. But you know, and you can look at the Olympics and go, God, Michael Phelps is amazing at swimming, but he'd be terrible at sprinting. And Usain Bolt, the opposite, you know, he'd be amazing at sprinting, but not very good at swimming. The same thing is true with our bodies Ben, you probably have some lifts that you're one of the strongest dudes in the world at, and other lifts that you've never been that good at.
Weak as a kitten, yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so Trent, I'm glad you brought that up, man, because that's a massive aspect of training that nobody thinks about is individual variances, because people watch you do a glute bridge and they go, oh, you know, I want to have glutes like Brett. That looks awesome. Or what, you know, arbitrarily, or they watch me squat and they go, I want to have legs like Ben, so I need to squat. But nobody ever thinks about how much individual biomechanics and variation comes into play. And that's really what I've spent the last couple of years teaching is, like, forget about what you see and lose the paradigm. This is why, you know, I think you had an exchange with one of my guys on social media just about the idea of internal versus external cueing, because if you're internally cueing somebody, it allows them to become aware of their own body and forget about the external environment. External cueing, I know it's become a kind of a trend in the industry right now, but like then I'm aware of what's happening outside of my body, and I lose focus on my mechanics, on my muscular abilities, on the objective I'm trying to achieve. So from a sports specific perspective, external cueing makes a lot of sense. From a hypertrophy style training, internal cueing to me only makes sense. And more importantly, internal cueing from my perspective allows people to become more introspective and aware of, hey, what's going on in my body right now, rather than going, I need to do a bench press because Branch Warren does a bench press or whomever, right?
It's funny because I've gotten in so many arguments with strength coaches over the years because, to me, every bodybuilder back in the day, I mean, back, remember I said when I was 15, I read every bodybuilding magazine, and every bodybuilder was like, you know, bench press used to not do that much for me until I learned how to bench press using my pecs. And they'd say things like, well, my biceps have gotten a lot better this year because I took the weight down and learned how to really contract them. And I grew up reading that, so it just became common knowledge. And then this Gabrielle Wolf, she's a researcher, and some of the strength coaches stumbled upon her work and started popularizing it, when she rightfully points out that any time you're trying to do a sports task, if you're trying to jump, you'd never be like, focus on your quads when you jump. That throws you off. So anytime it's like accuracy or force or like, and right before you squat, you wouldn't be like, squeeze your glutes. You don't want to think about the body. You want to think about the external environment or whatever motivates you. But
depending on your goal though, right? If your goal is lifting a weight, that's one thing. But if my goal is building muscle, then I would want to think about the muscle. Wouldn't I?
Exactly. So, yeah. When it's performance related or accuracy related, you focus externally. When it's to build muscle or to fix form, I always say that too. And then it's internal. And they're saying no, external is better for everything. I'm going, guys, there's no research on that. And so I've battled so many people, and I always say to these guys, okay, there's nothing wrong with the cues that we use. We don't have to reinvent the wheel. If your knees cave in a squat, you tell them knees out, and you show them what that means. You know, when you're at the bottom, your knees are doing this. I want you to think knees out. That's what fixes it best. And I say, give me an external cue for knees out. And they'll say, spread the floor. Spread the floor is different. That's not knees out. Right. You can spread the floor with your knees in, with your knees caved. And then they're like, well, show me your zipper. That's an internal cue. That's not an external cue. And they'll give me all these. No one can come up with a good external cue for knees out. There's nothing wrong with those cues. Chest up, knees out.
Right.
You know, the things we've always done to fix form. But then what's cool is Brad and I just got finished data collection. We're going to submit this for publication. We did the first study showing that mind-muscle connection builds biceps better than external cueing, and which you're nodding your head going, no kidding. But it was needed because that pendulum swing went in the opposite direction. People started thinking you don't need to pay attention to the muscles. And I got, especially for certain muscles like glutes and things that people don't tend to use much, or it doesn't come naturally for people. Like quads, I think people naturally use their quads well.
But what if someone's got 3-foot femurs, then they don't use their quads at all? You know, and this is where individual differences comes in, man. Like you may not use your pecs real, or maybe you do, whereas I lay down at a bench press on a 45-degree incline and I can still manage to figure out how to use my lower pecs, you know, like just based on sternal angle, you know, and acknowledging individual variances is massive.
I agree. So earlier you asked me, I never got around to answering it, who my biggest influences are. I think a lot of us read the book Super Training by Mel Siff and Yuri Volkoshansky in the day, and none of us understood any of it, but we love talking about it. But funny, I actually went back and read it just recently, and I remember looking up a couple of references that he made, and I was like, one with pelvic tilt, and I'm like, that doesn't say what that reference can't be used. But I wish he was still around because I think I'd be good friends with him. But he was, what I liked about him, and I think we should all strive to be like, it was all sports science to him. So now we have these camps, and you seem like you're like this, Ben. Like, we have these camps with the powerlifters, the bodybuilders, the strongmen, the weightlifters, the CrossFitters, the whatever, and then everyone scoffs at the other the other methods.
Right.
Whereas Mel was just like, look, it's all that blends into physical therapy, blends into this. It's all the same. It's all sports science. And I remember back in the day, he had this, you know, he mentioned reading that super training. He talked about loadless training, like flexing in the mirror, and he said that it could be a valuable training method for different reasons. And I remember having this argument with people, like, I bet you flexing gets you more, like, it helps the bodybuilders, you know,
absolutely
form muscle before the competition because they ramp up their flexing. And people go, no, you need resistance. Well, that same researcher I told you about, Lenicky, he did a study, and Brad and I argue about this. I'd like to hear your take, because Brad and I are always, we bicker like an old married couple, but we always argue, but we respect each other's viewpoints. This study had one, so each group served as their own control. So with one arm, they did dumbbell curls, like sets of 8 to 12 with progressive overload throughout like a 6-week period or whatever. And the other arm just did, just flex, like flexing your muscles as hard as you can throughout the full range of motion for 4 sets of 20 with like 30 seconds rest or something like that. That would be pretty hard to flex 20 times with only 30 seconds rest. So of course the dumbbell group saw way better strength gains, but they gained the same amount of muscle. But the no load group actually grew their triceps a little bit, because the triceps are what provide resistance for the bicep.
Right.
And so then, you know, Brad's rightfully points out, well, these were in untrained subjects, and it was short term. And then we got an argument. He's like, so you think that you could keep all your muscle without ever lifting weights again? And I'm like, yeah, I do, with a couple caveats. We work out for like an hour and a half, and we're doing lots of sets. When you go flex in the mirror, you'll flex for just a few minutes. If you actually like went into it like, all right, I'm going to flex pecs today, or like, and you flex it from all these different angles and used manual resistance, got up against like an immovable thing and did isometrics and stuff, and then did like flex and stretch, I think you could maintain your muscle.
You're not gonna build anything, I don't think, but I think you can maintain it, because I'm in this phase right now where I'm actually retired from bodybuilding and trying to lose 100 pounds of muscle, and it's the hardest thing I've done. It's way harder than bodybuilding, because you can't eat and you can't train. Otherwise, like, my muscle goes back up, even like no assistance or you know, just like completely natural. My testosterone levels are that of a 4-year-old girl, but it is what it is. You could absolutely maintain your muscle. And so I think from a training perspective, posing, I say that to everyone that comes through my gym, I think posing is one of the greatest unknown advantages for bodybuilders, because the more these guys pose, the more they can just connect with their muscle and have the ability to connect with their muscle in ranges that they may not have otherwise been able to connect. As well as offering the benefit of stability around a joint, right? Like if I can contract the muscle, all these joints function, or they cross joints. So all these muscles cross joints. So the benefit of a stable joint increases my output potential at a prime mover, right? So many things I think could be massively absolutely beneficial.
And what you mentioned from different ranges, because some people can be good at flexing a muscle from one range and not another, from one angle. So ideally. Well, I always tell my girls that with glutes, like, you should be able to squeeze the hell out of your glutes from any position, because some of them are like, I can't feel my glutes here, but I can from everywhere. But it took me a long time to work on that.
And then you get these strength coaches who say, well, you need to load it. Well, what business do I have loading if I can't even feel it without any load, right? Let's learn to feel it without load first, and then we can add incremental, you know, incremental stimulus.
Totally agree.
So what are you working on now, man? I think, you know, we've got some cool stuff, but I want to know what's getting you excited right now. I know you told us a little bit about, like, some of the things that are getting you excited, but what's on your radar?
Well, so right now I'm trying to move to San Diego. I put in for a house there. I don't know if I'll get it, but I want to get it. I got to get out of Phoenix, because it's not good for my business. It's too hot in the summers. I don't want to leave the house, and I can't use my garage, and so I could open up a facility here, but I'm like, why open up a facility if I can do it in San Diego? But then I want to really focus on having a better facility to carry out research and have some assistants that work for me and stuff, where we can do these training studies, because they're really hard to pull off on your own. you need a couple helpers. And that's a goal of mine. I'm working on a couple projects, but really my biggest thing that I have to do is to not take on too much. It's like I'm sure you can relate. Like financially, I'm doing well, and I love my life. But then I start taking on too many things, and then I don't enjoy it as much. And so it's like, yeah, money is cool, but being stressed out all the time is not cool. So where's that sweet spot that maximizes my happiness? Because we men are very driven. I mentioned winning the lottery earlier. You could win the lottery, Ben, and you wouldn't be like, cool, I can just coast now. You'd be going,
same thing.
Yeah. Now I can do this at a much grander scale. And
very true.
We don't know how to chill.
Very true. So it would be a disservice if I didn't ask for your three best glute tips for people out there listening, because I know you're called the glute guy. Or if you have any three muscle building tips in general or strength tips, what's your three biggest paradigm shifters that you want people to know that maybe you see mistakes out there being made?
Okay, so the good question. The first one would be, I never did eccentrics until a year ago.
Because they're too hard.
Oh, well, I hate them. I hate that. Yeah. I hate lowering it under. But I never played around with tempo that much. And as you get older, it took me like 20 years of lifting to where I finally understood how to auto-regulate. And it's such an important component to lifelong lifting. If you go into the gym and something doesn't feel right, don't do it. The most important thing is you not hurting yourself so you can keep making gains. We all are going to have little nagging little things that you'll have new ones every week that crop up and then they go away. And you got to learn how to train around things. And tempo is such a valuable tool for, you know, squats don't quite feel right. I'm a little nervous right now. So I'm going to do an eccentric accentuated pause squat, and you can take 100 pounds off and get an amazing workout with lighter loads, and then you don't hurt yourself, and then the next week you're back to normal. I know my pec started acting up with bench press, so I would just take 225 pounds and lower it for 6 seconds, and I could only do like 6 reps that way, and it's an awesome stimulus, and it doesn't put as much strain on the joints when you take a lighter load and lower it more slowly. So play around with tempo and learn how to use that to your advantage to stave off injuries and things like that. Train around pain and injuries and stuff like that. My second tip would be, you want an athletic body. You want a body that's in balance. And so we all tend to ignore, we're weak at certain things, and we tend to not just weak at certain with muscle groups, but with certain exercises. Typically, we all like the exercise where we can use the most load.
Yeah.
But like front squats for me, I hate them because I had to go down so much. Well, I learned to love front squats and learn to love the exercise that you suck at, because they're probably the ones that you should be doing.
That was my greatest advantage in bodybuilding, is I'd find something that I sucked at and I would do it for hours. I have stories of 17 sets of one arm dumbbell rows exclusively, just like back and forth. People are like, are you crazy? I'm like, man, I sucked at it, so I need to get good at it. So that's the fastest way to accelerate the learning curve.
And then third tip, I'll do one for glutes especially. For glutes, it's really like, I think there's a huge genetic component to program design, like we don't know enough about, with how much muscle damage you experience, how much you recover. But, and we don't know, there's not enough research there on like different loads, but you really want to make sure. So like most women fall into one camp. Well, this would apply to men too. You either like the high rep pumping stuff, or you like the heavy lifting stuff, and you tend to scoff at the other camp. But you should be doing both. You should be going heavy on certain lifts, and typically the compound lifts, but not necessarily if it doesn't suit your body well. But find some lifts that feel good to you when you go heavy and strive for progressive overload. but then do a lot of stuff where you're not trying to get stronger. You're not saying, I want to beat my record. You're going for quality and trying to feel the burn and get a pump. And you got to be doing all rep ranges for optimal results.
These are the things we dive deep on here, man. It's just the idea of varying your stimulus. And like you speak about, if you're not good at something, that's not a reason to avoid it. That's a reason to do it more often. And that hopefully will move the needle on every aspect, right? Like, if you're metabolically inefficient, well, let's train that. And let's see if that enables you to maybe train hard in a hypertrophy stimulus or in a tension style, like neurological type stimulus. So, man, brilliant, brilliant, great tips. The one thing I want to ask you about is maybe your impressions of why a glute may get less activation at the bottom of a squat. Knowing that we have the greatest distance from the axis at 90 degrees, why, from your perspective, is it getting – so is it just because the EMG is seeing the least amount of electrical activity? Is that kind of the deductive reasoning?
Yes, but this is what's so strange. This is currently – no one knows the answer to this. No one in the world. And this is what's something I'm trying to figure out. And it's funny because my buddy Andrew Vygotsky, who's now – he was my intern. Now he's way smarter than me. He's going into musculoskeletal modeling and biomedical engineering. And it's such a crazy field. But I was showing him – I'm like, look. I forwarded him an email from 6 years ago that I was emailing some of the people who now he's collaborating with, these world-class researchers like Sam Ward and Richard Lieber and these guys that are just muscle physiology geniuses. But it took me a while to realize, I thought someone's got to know this, but
yep.
What's so strange? Like, a lot of muscles contract have the highest EMG in the mid-range. And you can look at this by looking at MBIC positions when you do EMG research. Like, you get the highest electrical activity in a certain range. So for quadriceps, it's like kind of stretched at around 70 degrees. And for biceps, it's somewhere in the mid-range. For glutes, it's at the shortest possible range. Mm-hmm. It's at end range hip extension. And even when you shorten it by abducting and externally rotating, you get even higher. Well, why are the glutes different? So I've asked certain researchers, they'll say, well, it's to make up for the sarcomere shortening. You're getting higher EMG. Okay, well, if that's the case, then every muscle would be that way. You'd get the highest EMG in a shortened position, but you don't. Why are the glutes different? Is it something to do with their architecture? Is it something to do with evolution? I have a theory that it could be related to moment arm length and sarcomere short and muscle length, moment arm length, and evolution tied together. But
right.
We don't know the answer to that. No one knows the answer to that.
Now, here would be an interesting study to look at, is to see if that changes over time as someone becomes more trained, right? Maybe their muscle activation actually becomes less. That would be a good indication to see if, you know, it's an adaptation thing. Maybe because we never go into – when do we ever go into a fully shortened position of fully shortened glute? Basically never in day-to-day activity, right? So it's going to require a lot of neurological stimulus to get there.
You do when during gait, but the glutes aren't very active in gait because
right.
it's like a cyclical.
Certainly not loaded, right?
Right, right. But I agree. Like, can that activation curve change? But it might also just be that, like, at the bottom of squat, there's like an optimal amount of activation because it's stretched there and it gets a lot of passive force contribution to the torque. But
right.
Also the adductors are in a good position to provide a lot of hip extension torque down low. So that's what I really would like to see. And at one point I thought I had convinced Andrew to look at that for his PhD, but then he switched. But I want to look at, like, at the bottom of a squat, how high is each muscle activated? What are their muscle lengths? What are their moment arms? What are their – and then we could break down the individual contributors, how much each muscle contributes to – that hip extension torque down low versus up high, like in a hip thrust, how does that change? How does it shift?
Right.
And at the range of motion, well, you and any of a squat or hip thrust, you could put them in an isokinetic dynamometer and just show in a flex position versus an end range position. But there's a lot of factors that go into that, that go into how much torque you're producing, from the muscle size, the muscle leverage, the density of the muscle, or like the myofibrillar packing density that some people, it's just very, individual. Like some people can produce a lot more specific tension than others.
Sure. So in that study, was it a maximal squat or a submaximal squat that determined it was lower glute activity?
So there's so this is like a known thing. There's about 5 different studies I can point you to, but you can also, if you ever have access to an EMG unit, you can hook the electrodes up to your glutes.
And no, I believe you, but I'm thinking along the lines of,
you can get in the bottom of a squat and squeeze your glutes as hard as possible, or you can just have the heaviest load, and it only your glute EMG only gets up to, like, you know, at the bottom, like maybe 20-30% of max. When then you stand up and squeeze, and it'll get to 100% of max, and it's so weird because the most popular exercise for glute development are squats and lunges and deadlifts and things in a stretch position. And then you get the highest EMG output with things in a shortened position, like hip thrusts and back extensions where you squeeze the top. But I've always said you need both of those.
Of course.
The squats get you more range of motion. They're going to create more muscle damage. But then the hip thrusts and back extensions get you more tension at the top, and they get more metabolic stress. But we need more research on this, and like I said, I've been wrong before, but I think that hip thrusts are better for squats at hypertrophy, but I think you get both. You get the most glute growth with both, but this is an area we need more research on because we rely on anecdotes and logic. We need training studies, but it's hard to look at muscle growth with the glutes because ultrasound is hard to use with glutes. It's easier with other muscles. We prefer we'd have MRI, but MRI costs like $1 million. So we gotta get to the bottom of this over time. And I wish there were more people interested in glutes. But what's interesting is that there's now that I published some stuff on hip thrusts, like I told you about, there's now like 4 I've been asked to peer review like 4 of them. They're coming out. And so I think the wheels are turning, and there's going to be more research on glutes over time.
Great, man. Well, we have an EMG on the way here at the gym, man. I'd love to have you out because we got some big geeks in here who love to geek out about this stuff. That's all we do, man. You laugh. We sit around at like the front desk or in the we have a classroom here. You sit around the classroom for hours and just geek out about this stuff. And that's literally why I built it, man. It's all come to fruition. I've got 6 guys here who are absolutely brilliant minds, and they're each in their little genre and their little niche, and we all kind of collaborate on
I want to emulate your life right here because I that's what I want. And but I'll tell you something interesting that I don't think I've told many people. I don't think I've ever written a blog post on this. So knowing what I just told you about the muscle activation, because like think about it, if you flex your bicep and you're like the typical biceps pose and your arm is supinated, you can get a good biceps contraction, but then pronate it, you know, and all of a sudden it's not nearly as dense. So
right.
That's due to leverage and stuff, because you have better leverage and muscle length and stuff. But then with the glutes, I tried to do something similar. I got down to the bottom of a squat and just flexed my glutes as hard as I can. But then I did things like that stretch it further, like went into valgus collapse and caved my knees in.
Yeah, saw that. Yep.
An internal rotation and adduction.
Yep.
So that lengthens the glutes even more. And I would get like, and I was at the bottom, the very bottom of a squat, rock bottom. I'd get around 10% of my max glute activation. Then I'd stand up, get a little bit wider stance, flare my feet out, squeeze my glutes as hard as I can. Then you get 100% activation that way. So you can contract your glutes or activate your glutes 10 times more. That doesn't. But what about muscle growth? Does that mean that we should be doing like? So what does that mean for hyper? And that's the unique thing with glutes. You don't see that with other muscles. It's a very unique muscle. So then, what does that have to do with muscle hypertrophy? Does that mean should we be doing mostly one exercise or another? Should we be doing both of them? But that's a cool thing to show because the glutes are strange that way.
I have a very brilliant friend who's a neurophysiologist, and he's got his own EMG in his house, and he just geeks out on this stuff all day. He would be the guy to talk to about that, man, and I'll connect you guys if you're interested.
I love that.
He just loves it, man, and you love the guy's personality. He's an amazing, brilliant, brilliant guy, and he'll challenge everything you have to say and conversely be open-minded about everything you have to say. So, you know, those are the type of people we want to surround ourselves with, man. And speaking to, you know, if you ever want to come out here, it'd be great. We almost called this place the Muscle Intelligence Lab. We called the Muscle Intelligence Gym, but we almost called it a lab because I really wanted to get all this research.
Oh, I didn't know that's what MI stood for.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. So,
okay.
Yeah, man. So we're going to almost call it the lab. And I was like, but people aren't like, because it's still an active gym. I have 6 trainers full time. So I was like, oh, if we call it a lab, people may not, there might be a slight aversion. So we went with the gym, but it is still, man, it's our research baby. So
I'd love to meet you in person, so I'll take you up on that offer next time I'm out there.
Yeah, man. So I'm planning a Muscle Expert Symposium next February. If I can pull it all together in time, maybe push back. But if we can make schedules work, I'd love to have you speak there.
Awesome.
Awesome, Brett. Thanks very much for your time, man. I really do appreciate it. For all you listeners out there, BrettContreras.com. Brett is known as the Glute Guy. If you guys want to head over to iTunes and subscribe, leave us a review. If you have questions for Brett, you can find him on Instagram, which is where I found him. And I'm sure he's got Facebook and other cool stuff too. So have a great day and thank you for listening.
Join us on BenPokulski.com to learn the cutting edge techniques to take control of your body, your brain, and create your greatest life.